And we should be speaking in a few moments with Christopher Black and Phil. I don't know if I told you by way of preparation. I went to Bales Park. Last week we interviewed Svetlana Thomas, and I went to that, and I really wish, I hope many people were there. I think, we don't yet have the other gentleman on the line. I was going to include him in our conversation if he was here. It was great. There were thousands of people there, actually, and they were doing what I've always wanted to do. I wanted to be together with people celebrating the victory over fascism. And they did it.
Sounds wonderful.
They were holding so many of them, and some of them were quite, as the old, superannuated elderly people in their uniforms, men and women who had fought against fascism. Some of them were the medals from their shoulder to their waist. And I could not, I have to tell you, I cried because I heard the music, I heard the speeches. And I was thinking of my own family, members of which served, and I think they would have so much loved to have been present. They would like someone to carry their photograph. And by the way, we're going to be joined just really shortly by Chris Black, but one of the things I saw on coverage of the Moscow events, which was wonderful, attended, President Putin was carrying a photograph of his own father, and they interviewed him about him, and he said, well, he wasn't an officer, he was a soldier, and of course he's very proud of him. But I mean literally there were people in Bales Park walking through the crowd holding the picture up, and so I approached two or three and I said, excuse me, do you mind, could you tell me about this person? And then they did. It was very moving. The other thing was all the flowers, and with the veterans sitting there, and then people come and just weighing them down with flowers. Now that was the appropriate, that should have been, the whole city of Toronto should have been there for that. We're joined, I think, by Chris Black.
Yes, hello. How are you doing, Phil?
I don't know if you heard this, Chris, but
yes.
The weekends, there was a lot of moving. You have to have a heart of stone not to have been moved by reflections that you could see if you were seeking it out, the information on this celebration of the 7th anniversary of the surrender of, and let's put the words right, unconditional surrender of the Nazis.
Right.
And you have a piece written, and let's start with that. It's titled May 9th, Russian Victory, NATO Defeat.
Correct.
Well, please elaborate. How do you feel, by the way? Did you watch some of these events? What moved you?
I was unable to attend the Toronto events, but living up north of Toronto, but I watched the Moscow Victory Parade as much as I could. It was very moving with the Parade of the Immortals, as they called them, the survivors' families, or the surviving families of people
yes.
who had died during the war.
I like that idea of holding up the pictures.
Mm. Yeah, it was very
They should
emotional.
Pass it on. Each generation should carry those same pictures.
Yes, and because every country in Europe suffered losses, and my family suffered losses in the Blitz in London, but let's face it, 8 million, 10 million soldiers, Russian soldiers killed, 20 to 30 million Russian civilians killed. Nothing matches with that, nothing on that scale. So they suffered the most. And the point of my article was that the boycott by the NATO leaders of the Victory Parade was not just about the Ukraine events, but was larger than that. And to me, my view is that they don't see it as a victory over fascism. They see it as a defeat of the attempt by the West to subjugate Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't stand the fact that they, it wasn't just the Nazis, but the other Western nations also wanted to subjugate Russia. In fact, there was a plan.
Well, Canada participated in that
yes.
in 1917, wasn't it, or 1919?
Right. In the Bolshevik Revolution, 14 Western nations invaded Russia, including Canada, the United States and Britain and Japan, to suppress
Came home
the
with
revolution.
A bloody nose.
Right. And then in the Second World War, even before the war was concluded, Churchill and Patton echoed this, that the Western allies concocted a plan called Operation Unthinkable.
Mm-hmm.
that may not be the true name of it, but that's what they call it now, in which they were going to use the Canadian, British, and American forces combined with the surviving German armies to attack the Soviet forces in Europe. Yeah. And try and destroy them and invade Russia again.
Yeah. By the way, people with historical memories and knowing what the mood was in Europe, my own personal feeling is that those armies would have dissolved like salt in water.
Yes, and that's why they stopped. They stopped their plans when they further analysis by I think the British General Staff proved that the Soviet forces were just far too strong to.
We mentioned that on the program here last week that General Patton was the best known of the extremely reactionary, by the way, highly racist man. His whole family had a terrible, ugly history. He was one of those.
Right.
And he had a Jeep accident, as they say.
A mysterious Jeep accident, yeah.
But. So and the Germans too tried little games. They wanted to surrender only to the West.
Mm-hmm.
But fortunately, the alliance and that's where, by the way, your ancestors and mine, there was an alliance struck that held up despite these games. And and the Germans were told, no, you're going to have to come to the big meeting, and we're all going to be there.
Right. There was some attempts just a few days before by the British and the Americans to accept German surrenders in France and in Western Germany and Northern Europe, and treat that as a surrender of the German government. But the Soviets objected and said, look, we concluded an agreement a year before that the surrender would be of the entire German government in Berlin.
Yes.
And obviously the Soviet forces had captured Berlin and defeated the German army. And so they had to go along with the actual surrender. The real surrender was in Berlin on May 8th, 9th, depending on the date you...
Well, it was 8th, 9th. Yes, it was. Somebody, foolishly, in my opinion, left it too late in the day, causing to have a double day. It was 9th in Russia,
right.
Moscow, and it was the 8th in Berlin.
Correct.
I am, as they say, forgive me, I'm suspicious, but at any rate, But that alliance did hold up. You know, ending wars is really important. You're an international criminal lawyer. You know about this. I mean, who agreed to do what? And I know I've studied the American Civil War, and the various Confederate officers were working out their own arrangements. And many of those agreements had to be torn up because Washington said to the general, you have no power to make a deal with that man.
The Western Allies tried to treat the surrender on May 2nd, May 7th, I believe, in Italy and other places as the surrender, but the Russians could equally say, well, the first German armies to surrender was in Stalingrad in 1943.
Yeah.
So in that case, we won the war then.
Yeah, the war has been over for some time, if you can come talk to us about it.
Right, and the defeat of the Nazi forces in North Africa, there was no surrender. They captured large parts of the German army, but there was no surrender of the German army in North Africa. They left what was left of it.
Yeah.
So the first surrender was actually to the Russians.
Yes, and that, of course, was it. That's when everybody started changing their thinking about second fronts, promised second front that never came. And then after the Battle of Stalingrad, maybe we should get that second front cranked up. Or if we don't, we might meet our friends in Paris.
Exactly. That seems to be, looking back at history now, the motivation for the Normandy invasion was not necessarily to attack the Germans, but to stop the Soviets from advancing further west.
That has certainly been talked about.
Yeah.
And by the way, when armies do come from, they make a pincers, that becomes a very touchy matter as to who gets responsibility for. And Tolstoy tells us beautifully in War and Peace, how the Russians did once end up in Paris.
Yes.
And so people should remember. Now, we're talking to Chris Black, international criminal lawyer, and he has does so many things. And he's written this article. By the way, now this is available. The article we're referring to is a journal-neo.org, is it right?
Yeah, Scott, the actual title is New Eastern Outlook.
New Eastern Outlook. Right. So if they say go to New Eastern Outlook, they will find this article. It was published on, I think, the 4th of May, but it's certainly available, and it's Christopher Black. Now, Chris, you have a book, you yourself and Andrei Velchek, and how do you pronounce that?
Peter Koenig.
Koenig.
Yeah.
He's an economist and worked for the World Bank. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Mr. Velichek's one of the world's best-known high jeopardy journalists. Every time I read an article by him, I worry for him.
Because yes, he's a very passionate writer.
He goes to places where I say, are you sure you're going to be okay?
Yeah.
Now, so what? Tell us about the book and why the three of you, how you came to produce it.
I've been in touch with Andrei Velichek for a couple of years. Because of articles we saw each other writing, we got into contact by email, and we stayed in contact. And he approached me last year and said he and Peter Koenig had this project in mind of compiling some of their essays into book form, and asked if I'd be interested in putting some of my essays into it. And I just immediately said yes, because I admire very much what Andrei Velichek's trying to do, and Peter Koenig also. Peter Koenig is a World Bank former economist and advisor to the World Bank on projects around the world, and left, and is an anti-imperialist writer, and a very strong one. And Andrei Velichek is an historian and a journalist who writes from the same perspective, and I'm trying to write from that perspective. I was once a corporate lawyer a long time ago, but became a criminal lawyer, mainly working for legal aid.
Uh-huh.
But my experience in the war crimes tribunals in the ICTY and ICTR gave me a perspective and a chance to write about things I wouldn't have had before.
By the way, Velichek made a documentary about Rwanda.
Yes, he did.
That's one of the few that's really, to my mind, and I've followed, as you know, the events there as closely as most people, and it's an outstanding piece of work.
Yeah, it's one of the better ones. He's traveled all over the world. His energy is almost tireless, and I don't know how he gets the energy, but so we put the book together, and it's a compilation of our essays. We hope that people, and it's called Essays from the Resistance. And we don't want to sound presumptuous, but we regard ourselves as like your show and the central part of the resistance. We're trying to write from how most people we speak to think and how they see the world.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a chance to put it together and put it out there, so we put it together. And we hope people take it with that in that vein.
Yeah. Well, now you're writing on this on international matters. You've certainly picked up this business, the question of why didn't NATO disappear after the great, Yeltsin phenomenon and the Gorbachev phenomenon, and everybody said, well, the Cold War is over, et cetera. And then yourself and others noted that NATO didn't seem to go out of business. They seemed to actually jack it up a bit and seemed to be developing a project to encircle Russia and to dismember it, if I understand Mr. Brzezinski, who tends to be rather candid, dismember it, as well as China. I guess that makes us if you could talk on those themes, and I noticed China and Russia seem to be sitting together celebrating the victory over Nazism.
Yes, the president of China was there, Xi Jinping, and the Chinese fleet entered the Black Sea a few days ago to show support to the Russians. I'm sure there are now new naval exercises announced between the Russian and Chinese
navies. Do they have a navy as big as ours? Because we sent it one ship.
I think the Chinese navy is becoming
they better
quite
be careful.
Large now.
I mean, Mr. Harper has a ship over there.
Yeah, I think they sent in several guided missile frigates into the Black Sea, which...
Frigate is the word I thought of when I...
Yeah, they're very powerful ships. I think the Americans are a bit nervous about that. Mm-hmm. But there obviously is a counter show of force, because quite clearly, in my view, your view, I'm sure, that the events in Ukraine are a follow-up from the attack on Yugoslavia and all these other wars, as I say in my article, to eliminate Russian allies or put NATO closer up to the Russian border. Quite clear that if you look at the whole strategy over the last 20 years that's followed the Soviet Union, that it continues the plan of 1945, which was to try and subjugate Russia. And they thought they had, under Yeltsin, they thought they had Russia in their pocket. But then
turned out they had Yeltsin.
Yeah, it turned out they just had Yeltsin in their pocket, but not Russia, and people
and
in
then
Russia
there was
realized
a
it.
Strong aroma of vodka.
Yes. So now, as like Andrei Velichek said, we're not happy. Russia's no longer socialist, but still, it's an anti-imperialist country, and it stands for principles and still international law. And we have to support that.
By the way, that's almost becoming a revolutionary position to call for international law.
Yes.
For the non-interference in internal affairs, for the non-murdering of foreign nationals or your own nationals on foreign territory.
Right. Yeah, it's just...
If you insist on that, you are a bloody terrorist.
Yes. If you don't bow down to the imperialist powers, the United States and its allies, including Canada, then you know they treat you like a gangster, and you gotta be suppressed. But they're being stopped, yeah. Or I hope so.
Well, certainly things are developing. I mean, now we had on this program James Bissett. I think mm-hmm. you know Mr. Bissett.
Yeah.
He was a former really distinguished Canadian ambassador, diplomat, and the things he was saying really parallel your own. He's simply calling for a respect for international law, the command of the founding of the United Nations, which is no one is supposed to engage in aggression without seeking going to elaborate lengths to try to achieve peaceful resolution, and he finds himself in a position where no one wants to hear that, and here he is the retired diplomat. And he said that for him it all began with Serbia. He said when they bombed Serbia, he said they threw all the rules and all international law out the window.
That's totally correct.
And you had the client, Mr. Milosevic. You
yes.
know that intimately.
And the war against Yugoslavia was an attack on a European country by NATO. Outside the United Nations was totally illegal. It was just a war of aggression to eliminate a socialist country and a country which relied on its own sovereignty. I was an ally of Russia at that time.
My recollection...
I had to put in place a big American base on the southwest flank of Russia in Camp Bondsteel.
Yeah, could you tell us what that is? That's in Kosovo, right?
Yeah, I think they deliberately split off Kosovo, the province of Kosovo from Serbia, in order to put that base there. Camp Bondsteel, I understand, is the biggest American base in the world. And it's what's it there for?
And I assume the reason that evidence that it is so large and dangerous is that no one talks about it.
No one talks about it, but it's it can't... What's its purpose? It's on the southwest flank, and I suspect, and I've talked to some Russian and Serbian or former Yugoslavian general officers, and they said it's because they want to attack from... a pincer attack from the west and from the southwest. Mm-hmm. The pincer moved up through Ukraine and combined with the force in Ukraine. And that's what Ukraine's all about, really,
mm-hmm.
To generate or place themselves for an eventual attack on Russia.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that doesn't take place, but that's what it looks like.
Well, indeed, and particularly since going back to this point, that the struggle to have respect for international law is actually... is the radical position.
That's right. Yeah.
The people who insist on that are getting in the way of Obama and his policy.
Yeah, I think I saw a quote today of Putin saying that the Americans said they weren't, said something about international law, and he quipped that it's odd that they mentioned that, at least they recognize there is such a thing as international law. I thought they forgot about it.
Yeah. Well, he might want to ask for more evidence. Incidentally, now that we've merged into Serbian thing, I recalled when those bombs were falling on Serbia that the president, I guess he was a prime minister, I forget his title, chancellor, pardon me, of Germany at that time, was very proud that for the first time since World War II, German aircraft were part of a mission,
right.
And the mission was bombing Yugoslavia, which would be kind of like old home week for them.
Yes, yes. And I mentioned, I know in 2007 I was in Addis Ababa. I saw Luftwaffe planes on the tarmac at the airport in Addis Ababa. What were they doing there?
Well, what were you doing there?
Yeah, what were they doing? I was surprised. I saw like 10 big Luftwaffe planes lined up there, and I was surprised by it.
That is sobering, isn't it? That's like recently a South African, a Saudi Arabian plane was recently seen in Tel Aviv, and someone said, well, what's that doing there?
Yeah,
Turns out they do the repair work on the Saudi planes.
Oh.
At least that's what they said they're doing. I don't
right,
know.
Right, right.
Yeah, look at this. I mean, you're the man to explain to us about it. We have Yemen being bombed. Ban Ki-moon attends meetings where the Saudis
yes.
Say, well, we're going to bomb the sovereign country of Yemen.
Yes,
and he sits there at their elbow while they do it.
Right, and he made some statements about Burundi recently, and as you probably know, Bensouda.
Oh, yes, I wanted to ask you about Ms. Bensouda threatening Burundi.
And that's exactly what it was. I checked that out, and it's quite clear the timing and the sequence of the events. The EU and the USA are now putting pressure on the president of Burundi, Nkurunziza, mm-hmm. not to run for election.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a Hutu who came to power after a civil war. And the threat, or the pressure by the U.S. and EU is now followed by Bensouda, the International Criminal Court, putting out a warning that if there's further trouble in Burundi, that she may act against somebody.
Yes, persons on...
Well, but then there's only been a handful of people killed in protests in Bujumbura, but otherwise the countryside's pretty quiet. And how does she know there are going to be protests, they're going to escalate?
But by the way, Chris, couldn't that, if you were arguing for someone, that's like incitement, right? When they hear
exactly.
that you've said that, you would be tempted, if you're in the opposition in Burundi, you'd be tempted to have a little incident.
Exactly.
Then you have her on your side.
That's right. So it's direct political interference. Again, the ICC shows itself to be a completely political tool of the United States and Britain and the EU.
Mm-hmm.
And putting out, as a disguise as a warning, an actual threat, that if you don't do what we tell you, there are going to be escalations, people are going to be hurt, and we're going to say it's your fault.
Yeah.
And then we're going to act. And it's interesting, on May 1st, the Russians and Chinese vetoed a French resolution, probably backed by the Americans, to send in forces to intervene in Burundi. And the Russians and Chinese said, no, this is a matter of national sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
They had their own constitution. The elections are being deemed legitimate by the Constitutional Court in Burundi.
Yes.
Nothing wrong. What's your problem?
Yes. And by the way, if there is a problem, you have to make a case,
mm-hmm.
and you have to bring it into the Security Council and argue it.
That's right.
Instead, they all want to, you know, you and I both know from the Yugoslav experience, the Rwanda experience, is that it's all hurry up and do it. Because, something might happen. They did this with Sudan. They did it, with Kenya.
Yes.
And they tried to remove the president of Kenya.
Right. And they overthrew Gbagbo. She uses her examples, Cote d'Ivoire and Kenya. Now, Kenya, we know the charges were all politically rigged. And we know that President Gbagbo was overthrown by the French and with American help.
Yes.
And the ICC helped. Now, Gbagbo is in prison for several years now with no real charges against him, no trial, but he's taken out of the system.
Exactly.
And Charles Blay Goudi also.
And his party is criminalized.
His party is criminalized, and so they're using these courts as, like I said many times before, these ad hoc tribunals, but now the ICC are acting like really fascist courts, where they don't apply the law, they're used for political, more like an inquisition, basically.
Yeah. No, this is Christopher Black. Oh, by the way, I better get back and mention the title of your book. I'm looking for it as we speak. What is it?
We call it The World Order and Revolution, mm-hmm. Essays from the Resistance. So our essays are about what we see as the world order presently and the possibilities for changing it.
Mm-hmm.
And Essays from the Resistance, well, we regard ourselves as part of the resistance. We're not the leaders of it, of course. But
we're not the only ones carrying a banner.
No, we're just three people who feel we're part of the resistance. We wanted to express our views, and we had the chance to put the book out. We hope people find it interesting and stimulating.
And it is now available. It's ready.
Yes, it's now on Amazon. It's now available on Amazon.
The World Order and Revolution, Essays from the Resistance.
Correct.
And it's, of course, the authors are... Christopher Black, Andre Velchek, and Mr. Koenig. Is it Koenig?
Peter Koenig.
Koenig.
Yes. He's Swiss, but with a German background.
I really like the fact that, of course, he has this experience with the World Bank, because, as you know, from the working international law, all these tribunals always end up with, it turns out that the World Bank had a lot to say about the crises that within countries that caused conditions that led to charges, et cetera.
Right.
You always find World Bank employees.
Yes. And in fact, it was interesting.
Including, you mentioned Ivory Coast.
Yes.
The new president of Ivory Coast was a World Bank guy.
Yeah, it was curious. In the trial for General Ndiliman at the Rwanda Tribunal, we raised the history of the Rwandan war and how the IMF and the World Bank interfered and helped promote that war or provoke it or set up the circumstances for it. And the judges, the president of the court from Sri Lanka said, Mr. Black, you don't need to tell us what how the IMF and the World Bank work. All the judges here know exactly how they work. I found it very surprising, but today that's what they said.
And you said, well, then I'll meet you outside after the acquittal. Right. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Well, Christopher, it's great talking to you. You covered a lot of ground.
And
we hope that everybody gets a copy of this book, and we look forward to talking to you soon.
Okay, you're welcome.
Thank you. That's Christopher Black. And again, I'll remind you, you'd love to watch me find my notes every time I'm about to say something, I notice, well, where'd my notes go? There we are, the World Order and Revolution, Essays from the Resistance. The authors are Andre Velcik, Peter Koenig, and Christopher Black. And now I'll remind you that coming up on the 13th at Betsatun, Wednesday, May 13th, 7 p.m., 612 Markham, and that is Professor Michael Kiefer, and it is a book launch for Hard Truths for Canada about Israel and Palestine. And we hope people will attend. And on Friday at 7 p.m., May 15, Cuban Dr. Jose Garcia, who has led the Cuban international missions in Africa in the struggle, one of the leaders in the fight against Ebola, and the title of his talk is Africa Called and Cuba Answered. And again, Friday, 7 p.m., May 15th. So the 15th and the 13th, two very important talks going on in the city, Betsatun, and a different book list. And Phil is here. Phil, you are going to have on your show Wednesday at 6 p.m.
Well, I have a lot of excitement. Yes, I'm going to have Lynn Slotkin in to review these
Slotkin
interesting operas that are on right now, Bluebeard's Castle and Erwartung. And I've also unearthed a brand new troupe in town that is going to specialize in Brecht, and they're going to make their premiere performance shortly, and I'm having them on the program. They're going to be doing a cabaret performance of The Seven Deadly Sins, music of Kurt Weill and a book by Bertolt Brecht.
And did you say it's a Toronto-based group?
It's a Toronto-based group, yes, right in downtown Toronto. We're going to have them in the program on Wednesday night as well.
Well, tell them I've already joined their fan club, even though they don't have it yet. So that will be Wednesday.
That'll be Wednesday at 6 o'clock here at CIUT. Yeah.
And I want to say again, the Russian Congress of Canada, the Russian, you can find it, RussianCongressCanada.org. And as my mother would say, bless their hearts for the Saturday, May 9, Bales Park March. They had a march down Bathurst Street. They held up the photographs of those who had loved ones who had served in the war against fascism, which was the greatest war in history. Don't forget it. And I don't want to use all the ghastly numbers who lost their lives, but just look it up. And it was won, and that victory should be celebrated every May 8, 9, and we should all bring the photographs of those who gave their lives and offered their lives in the struggle against fascism. So I'm going to read that again. Make sure you go to the site, RussianCongressCanada.org. And Lucas, thank you very much. Phil Conlon, thank you very much. This is Phil Taylor for the Taylor Report. Hey, on our Twitter is say it again.
@Taylor_report.
Okay, we'll look for you next week.